Well, it's been a bit, but Alex, so glad to have you back on a podcast and glad to have a podcast
It's always a good time to have a podcast.
back. Well, so we are coming back to talk about the 2022 Sao Paulo Grand Prix, formerly known as Brazil, and experimenting a little bit with the form of what open wheel open mic looks like. Any subsequent episodes that we put out are gonna play around with the format, play around with the topics. One of those such experiments is an all F1 podcast, which is with IndyCar long since completed their season. We can talk about nothing but Formula One, like Netflix does. I get Drive to Survive recommended to me constantly, and I haven't seen the new seasons. Listeners, you didn't see the sort of like lazy swipe that Alex just took at the camera.
It's fantastic watching for someone who's looking to get the gist of Formula One, but after watching and writing about the entire season for however many weeks on end. What would my grandmother have said? Drive to survive, don't show me nothing.
It's really cool that some of my friends now know what to talk to me about, which I think is the biggest plus. We get more races in the US and it's feasible to hold them, and it's a good thing for the sport. But also on a personal level, it's nice that friends can actually talk to me about something. Let's talk
Open up your
about,
social wings a little bit.
oh yeah, no, it's nice. Let's talk about F1. Let's do it. Something which I'm sure is going to be a highlight in the new season of Drive to Survive. Kevin Magnussen got the pole. Let's go right out and say it. Just Alex, initial thoughts on that sentence that I just said.
USA. It's made even more legendary and more of a biblical scene, as Arva would say, that Haas not only took the pole in that race, but then Schumacher took 20th, and not only did they completely shock the entire motorsport universe, but managed to bookend the field in the process. And wow. Haas is a team that I feel like every American F1 fan wants to take pride in. And there have been times that Haas has not made it very easy. And most of that, in my mind, is forgiven after such an out of left field performance like Haas and Magnussen put on in Sao Paulo.
Yeah, because it was the performance. In Q3, 8 of the 10 drivers got in a legitimate on slicks qualifying lap. Sergio Perez and Charles Leclerc both had sort of weird things that made their laps compromised. Leclerc on the wrong tires, Perez stuck behind Leclerc. But everyone got one lap, and Kevin Magnussen set the fastest one. And then the rain fell, and no one could beat the time. So, for a team that has kind of been the butt of a lot of jokes over the, especially since 2019, with first Rich Energy and then the whole deal with Nikita Mazepin, to sort of finally be able to put a performance together and get a little taste of what the front of the grid is like for Haas. And it was a little taste, that's to be sure. Magnussen fell to 8th place by the end of the sprint and failed to complete the first lap of the race after getting hit by Daniel Ricciardo. So Haas got 1 point from the entire weekend, but what a weekend it was.
When the skies aligned, but they didn't stay aligned for too long. That was truly tragic, especially on the first lap. A move like that from a driver of Ricardo's caliber and with Ricardo's experience was so just un absolutely unforeseeable, as far as I can tell. And of all the people in the field, it could have happened to. The drivers' championship's already locked up. For in a lot of ways, Magnussen's pole was the most consequential thing going on toward the front of the field throughout the weekend, and then to have that torn apart before five corners had passed on Sunday was abhorrent.
Yeah, well, he did get a great start to the sprint.
Yes, he did.
We did. This was the third and final of the sprint events in 2022. Technically speaking, mm-hmm. it's not called a sprint race, and it's not called sprint qualifying. It's just a sprint. We're going to have to get used to that little grammatical oddity, because they're scheduled to be six sprint events in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And many among the media and among drivers, including Max Verstappen, aren't the biggest fans of the format. Mm-hmm. But I would say, and I think you might agree with me, that this was the best sprint we've seen in Formula One.
I would have to say so, despite all the validity of the criticisms regarding the sprint format. I think the way the one in Brazil played out, and the way the one in Brazil played out last year with Hamilton flying through the field like he did, is about as good of a case for the sprint format as you're going to make. It may come down to the tracks you do it on rather than the format itself. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I will say personally, I'm not the biggest fan of the sprint as an element of Grand Prix weekend, but
mm-hmm.
when there's good racing, I got to call it good racing. The highlight, I guess, at the front of the field in the sprint, Kevin Magnussen got a great start, but he lost the lead on lap three to Max Verstappen, and he ended up eighth. But then starting from third, George Russell just tracked down Max Verstappen, passed him, and won the thing. Which, considering where Mercedes was at the start of the season and even where they were as recently as last time out in Mexico, totally unexpected.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, let's get into our, I guess, the main story of the weekend. Some nice, spicy intra-team conflict. Just about everybody hates their teammate more than when they got there, which, if we're talking about Drive to Survive, is going to make for some great streaming television content. It happened pretty early on in that sprint. Alpine teammates Fernando Alonso and Esteban Ocon got together on the first and the fourth lap. That resulted in a broken front wing for Alonso and a terrible performance because he had to pit to fix it. What Alonso had to say after the sprint about his teammate was, "It's one more race and then it's over." Not so willing to extend the olive branch, was he?
Absolutely not. And that's one that I'm trying to take with a bit of a pinch of salt, because Alonso is notoriously hard to work with. You know, we saw that at Ferrari. We saw that at McLaren both times, especially the first time. At the same time, though, Ocon's driving in Brazil was a bit Lance Stroll-y. And how convenient, because of who Alonso is going to be teamed up with this coming year, and who Alonso has already been involved in a pretty consequential incident with once, and who was also involved with his own teammate in an incident that was also a display of some pretty questionable defensive driving. So it almost looks to me like a situation where, yes, two wrongs don't make a right, and yes, one person was in the wrong more than the other, but there's also a level of that one line from Family Guy, like season six or something, where the father just has to say, "Kids, you're both just awful."
I think it's worth mentioning that Ocon has had similar relationships with teammates in the past. Mm-hmm. When he and Perez were at the team formerly known as Force India, they had a bad habit of crashing into each other. To add another dimension to the Alonso and Ocon moment, during the race at the final safety car restart, Ocon was ahead of Alonso, who had a tire advantage, and the team asked Ocon to move out of the way and let Fernando through. And what he said was, and I quote, "Let me race at the moment. I will once the situation is settled." Mm-hmm. And he did not say it as calmly and politely as I just did. So it's something we tend to have to talk about sometimes. So, but Alex, what do you think about team orders? Do you think it's an appropriate thing to happen in top level motor racing?
Appropriate is a strong word. I would almost call it a necessary evil, because when teams are not allowed to exercise some strategic control over their drivers on track, they're going to do it in more deceitful and mischievous ways. And in that, that's one of the many roads that can lead you into a crashgate situation.
Or the Fernando is faster than you. Can you confirm you've received this message from the 2010 German Grand Prix?
Yeah, even better, just as good. the sanctioning body would do well to remember that the teams can give whatever orders they want. There have been instances where the drivers have ignored them. And we'll get to one of those in this episode, but there, I'm thinking about other instances from years past as well. I personally, from a just plain strategic conduct in sports point of view, don't see anything wrong with them. I do understand that there's an issue of sportsmanship or integrity that goes along with it, but we don't live in a perfect world. I don't see the benefit of the teams and or the FIA, you know, bending over backwards trying to find a solution to this, air quotes, because you can't see it, but I'm doing them, problem.
The podcast maybe is less fun when we agree on everything, but I totally agree with you. I think I've played enough Motorsport Manager to respect making a swap. Of course, you never like to see a race win go away. You never want to see someone lose out on a win for team reasons. But
multi-21, Jim. Multi-21.
Well, I mean, hey, Vettel didn't lose on the race win because of that.
No.
Mark
Webber.
So yeah, it is. I guess necessary evil is a good way of putting it. Because otherwise, you get sort of farcical coded messages that don't mean anything, and
right.
That's probably more embarrassing.
Yeah, imagine an F1. Your arm is probably itching. Why don't you scratch it for a moment? I mean, it would be the line. I don't know where exactly to draw, but the line is somewhere around right there.
So, you mentioned Multi-21 and Red Bull team orders being ignored. Well, Max Verstappen certainly had an up and down day at the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, which I wrote about in an article on frontstretch.com. just gotta plug, you know, acting blatant self-interest there.
There you go.
But on his journey back to the back and to the front and to the back and to the front, eventually sort of in the middle, Perez, who was on old medium tires, was asked to let Verstappen through for sixth place. Think because Red Bull thought that maybe on his new tires, Verstappen could pass Alonso and Leclerc for fifth and fourth. He didn't have time to get there, and his car was damaged from that earlier crash with Hamilton. And so on the final straightaway, Red Bull told Verstappen, if you haven't passed Alonso by turn 12, just slow and let Checo take the position back. Mm-hmm. Because he's in a pretty tight fight for second place in the standings. And what Verstappen said, and I'm going to quote this directly, was, I told you already last time, you guys don't ask that again. I gave my reasons and I stand by it. And then when Horner went on the radio and told Perez, hey, sorry, we told Verstappen to let you by and he didn't. Perez says, it shows you who he really is.
Mm-hmm.
What I guess I want to know from you, Alex, is for a duo that have sort of been so willing to work with each other over the last 2 years, what impact could that have on the 1-2 dynamic at Red Bull and the future of both Verstappen and Perez at the team.
Well, I should qualify this all in the context of it needs to be kept in mind that Max Verstappen was given a position by his teammate and then refused to give a position back that he had never taken organically. If Verstappen had just swooped by Perez on the outside of turn three and then refused to give up the position, that would be another story. But the fact that Red Bull had Verstappen was in that position largely by virtue of the team ordering Perez to give it to him, that makes the fact that he refused to give it back that much more difficult to swallow. That's where the issue really stops being an issue for me. That's what really irks me about it. As far as their history, I think that while they have worked together, it has largely been Perez being the number two driver to Verstappen's championship efforts in both years. I mean, he more or less had Spain won this year and was made to move out of the lead for Verstappen to come through. Now, granted, the championship, I guess, was tight at that point in the year. I'm not sure in F1 if you're really racing for the championship at round five, but that's neither here nor there. The team and Verstappen need to both be sure that they don't end up with a second driver who feels like he's given everything and got very little in return, because then you just have someone who could be out to get you and is wearing the same colors rather than having an active, healthy team relationship. If I was Perez, I'm in no mood to do anything for Max for the rest of my time at Red Bull.
Well, it was Abu Dhabi last year where Checo defended against Hamilton for Verstappen's sake. And Verstappen
defended like hell.
Yeah, it was some incredible piece of driving. And we've seen a lot of really impressive defensive driving from Perez, often for the sake of Verstappen. But Verstappen called him a legend on the radio for that. That's sort of, and it's been sort of taken up as a slogan by the F1 community when talking about Perez and his impressive defensive driving. The Mexican Minister of Defense, which is such a British way of saying that too. Because they spell it with a C and everything. I mean, if I were Perez, I'd certainly not want to give Verstappen a spot ever again. But it just, to me, it seems so one-sided. I mean, Verstappen is so clearly the number one driver that it doesn't matter what Perez does, because if he stops playing Red Bull's game, they can just drop him, and they could drop him mid-season for whoever's in the AlphaTauri, because that's what Red Bull does. Although I think maybe the relative weakness of their lineup as now even Gasly is leaving the Red Bull program. Maybe gives Perez a little bit more job security, as well as the fact that he's won a couple of Grand Prix for the team. But still, I mean,
the prospect of Tsunoda and Verstappen, the Red Bull lineup, is the stuff of nightmares. I can feel my blood pressure going up already.
Yeah, we got. I mean, I guess looking into the future right now for F1, the only thing that's left to settle. The only thing that's really close left to settle heading into Abu Dhabi is second place in the Drivers' Championship, where Perez and Leclerc are tied. And I mean, that's kind of it. It hasn't been as tense of a season as it was last year.
It'll be interesting because Horner made it clear after in the aftermath of the Red Bull fallout in Sao Paulo that Max would help Perez in Abu Dhabi, if at all possible. That's a very nice sentiment, but I don't know how you feel. I'm not convinced just yet.
Well, I think it's worth then mentioning why supposedly Verstappen didn't want to give the place back, which is there's a sort of a bit of a conspiracy theory that Perez crashed on purpose in qualifying in Monaco. And Verstappen felt so slighted by having his chance to win the Monaco Grand Prix taken away that was in May, and now in November he's refusing to yield sixth place at Brazil so that Perez can have a better Drivers' Championship finish when Verstappen's already locked up the, he set the record for most wins in a season right. already. He's locked up the world championship. Like, what else does he need?
To prove a point, I guess. I don't understand it. It almost seems a little bit too convenient for that to be the reason. Like you said, 6 months later, once the championship, once the wins record and everything is locked up, it seems like one of those excuses and reasons you come up with after you do something questionable to justify it rather than that being the motivation in the first place.
I do think it's a little interesting. You mentioned that because the fact, I mean, a lot has been said about Max Verstappen's mm-hmm. like dedication to winning and his sort of, mm-hmm. I mean, his relationship with his dad that's like got some sort of horrific caveats to it. But like the fact that someone can be so all consumed by the desire to win that they're not going to give the spot to your teammate for sixth place after you've already locked up the championship. Like, I guess that's why I could never be a Formula One driver because like in Verstappen's position, I would barely be trying. I'd have whatever the world championship equivalent of senioritis is. And so, yeah, it's definitely an interesting insight into the way that an incredibly talented and hyper-competitive Formula One driver thinks, whether or not he's holding a grudge from Monaco or if he just will not ever cede a position. Either way is a really fascinating topic for conversation. And I guess to wrap things up, we're going to talk about the one team with no drama, maybe surprisingly so, was Mercedes, because we said George Russell won the sprint. He also won the race pretty easily, I would say. After Lewis got sort of sent mid-pack after that contact with Verstappen. And then, I mean, Mercedes said, the team came over the radio and said, yeah, you guys are racing. That those final 12 laps, I believe what they said exactly was, you're racing, be respectful. Because, you know, they don't want to lose out on a 1-2. But, I mean, George put the hammer down. And Lewis was never able to get within that 1 second for DRS. And that was it. George Russell won his first career Grand Prix.
That was shocking. With the position that Lewis was in and how this season's gone from and how close he's come in the past, you know, Carlos Sainz gets one flat tire at Silverstone or, you know, some other alternate situation like that. And Lewis has that win to continue his consecutive winning season's record. And it was amazing that George was able to keep him just so barely out of reach for that last stint. It's a testament to, as I think a lot of people still kind of view George as the apprentice to Lewis at Mercedes, which is perfectly fair given the experience differential and whatnot. But throughout the course of that race in Brazil, there was nothing apprentice-like about the way Russell handled himself.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's fantastic that after so many years of Valtteri Bottas playing second fiddle to Hamilton at Mercedes, yeah, that they're willing to let the two drivers handle things on track between themselves. That's supposedly the way Mercedes has always done it. But in the last couple of years, it was a lot more one-sided than that, at least sort of watching it happen on track.
Oh yeah.
So I'm just interested in what you, because if George Russell is able to drive on this level, if he's able to even just sometimes be the better of Hamilton, mm-hmm. I will caveat by saying that I think that over the course of the full season, I think Lewis has looked faster for most of it, even though George Russell, to his credit, has had the highlights. He's had the wins, he's had the poles, and he's ahead in the championship. But yeah, this idea of the apprentice and the master Do you see any tension, any underlying tension in that relationship that could make things interesting, even if Mercedes sort of returns to that level of dominance we've seen from them?
I don't think I see any tension right away, but where I do see the opportunity for Hamilton-Rosberg style tension to arise is that even to what has surprised me about Russell since he made his Mercedes debut subbing for Hamilton at the end of 2020 and nearly locked up the race win until that dreadful tire saga played out, was that, like Verstappen, for his level of experience, Russell seems to eat pressure for breakfast. Making that Mercedes debut and controlling the race as well as he did and then running so perfectly with Hamilton breathing down his neck, I don't think that the experience or the stature of his teammate is going to shake him as much as someone who's trying to be a bit Machiavellian in their strategy might think.
Yeah, the thing with Russell, though, I don't know if I'd agree with you on that, which is great because we are agreeing too much. But I mean, we've definitely seen the cracks in Russell's armor when he was at Williams. The big crash with Bottas at Imola. Twice he crashed under safety car while in position for his first career points. But I will agree with you that he is quite a complete driver. Mm-hmm. And it will be interesting. I think this first season at Mercedes, as sort of the expectations were a little bit lower, not just he's up against Lewis Hamilton, the 7-time world champion, but also their car is a bit crap. And he did really shine, particularly at the start of the season when Hamilton was struggling. I think that Lewis Hamilton, I think every F1 driver wants to win to like that insane amount I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And so even the best teammate, even if their relationship is currently as well on the track as it is off of it, I think 2023 is going to be really interesting.
I would be inclined to agree, especially if they get their car together and can return to being consistently at the front of the grid like they have been for the past, oh goodness, what was it, 7 years up to this point?
Well, it is going to be fun. Well, it looks like that's all the time we have for this episode and this season of Open Wheel Open Mic, a podcast from frontstretch.com, available on anywhere you get your podcasts. Alex, thanks for coming on the show, and thanks for coming on so many times.
It's always a good time. I'll be back.
Okay, but now say it again in an impression of Toto Wolff.
It's always a good time.
That was just a joke about the Austrian accent. So you said, I'll be back.
Yeah, like Arnold.